Poison gas in World War I, from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. http://en.wikipedia.org. The use of poison gas in World War I was a major military innovation. The gases used ranged from tear gas to disabling chemicals such as mustard gas and killing agents like phosgene. This chemical warfare was a major component of the first global war and first total war of the 20th century. The killing capacity of gas was limited. Only 3% of combat deaths were due to gas. However, the proportion of non-fatal casualties was high, and gas remained one of the soldiers' greatest fears. Unlike most other weapons of the period, it was possible to develop effective countermeasures to gas. Hence, in the later stages of the war, as the use of gas increased, in many cases its effectiveness was diminished. Because of this widespread use of chemical warfare, as well as critical wartime advances in the manufacture of high explosives, World War I is often referred to as the Chemist's War. History. 1914. Tear gas. The early uses of chemicals as weapons were as a tear-inducing irritant, lacrimatory, rather than fatal or disabling poisons. Although many believed that gases were first used in World War I, there are accounts that sulfur gas was used in the 5th century BC by the Spartans. During the First World War, the French were the first to employ gas, using grenades filled with tear gas, xylyl bromide, in August 1914. Germany retaliated in kind in October 1914, firing shrapnel shells filled with a chemical irritant against French positions at Neuve Chapelle, though the concentration achieved was so small it was barely noticed. 1915. Large-scale use in lethal gases. Germany was the first to make large-scale use of gas as a weapon. On the 31st of January, 1915, 18,000 artillery shells containing liquid xylyl bromide tear gas, known as Tista, were fired on Russian positions on the Rawka River, west of Warsaw, during the Battle of Bolomov. Instead of vaporizing, however, the chemical froze, completely failing to have an impact. Chlorine became the first killing agent to be employed. German chemical conglomerate IG Farben had been producing chlorine as a byproduct of their dye manufacturing. In cooperation with Fritz Haber of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Chemistry in Berlin, they began developing methods of discharging chlorine gas against enemy trenches. By 22nd of April 1915, the German army had 160 tons of chlorine deployed in 5,730 cylinders opposite Langemark, north of Ypres. At 1700, in a slight easterly breeze, the gas was released, forming a gray-green cloud that drifted across positions held by French colonial troops who broke, abandoning their trenches and creating an 8,000-yard, 7-kilometer gap in the Allied line. However, the German infantry were also aware of the gas and lacked reinforcements, and therefore failed to exploit the break before Canadian and British reinforcements arrived. In what became the Second Battle of Ypres, the Germans used gas on three more occasions, on 24th of April against the Canadian 1st Division, on 2nd May near Mousetrap Farm, and on 5th of May against the British at Hill 60. At this stage, defenses against the gas were non-existent. The British official history stated that at Hill 60, 90 men died from gas poisoning in the trenches. Of the 207 brought to the nearest dressing stations, 46 died almost immediately, and 12 after long suffering. Chlorine proved inefficient as a weapon. It produced a visible greenish cloud and strong odor, making it easy to detect. It was water-soluble, so the simple expedient of covering the mouth and nose with a damp cloth was effective at reducing the impact of the gas. It was thought to be even more effective to use urine rather than water, as the ammonia would neutralize the chlorine, but it is now known that ammonia and chlorine can produce hazardously toxic fumes. Chlorine required a concentration of 1,000 parts per million to be fatal, destroying tissue in the lungs. Despite its limitations, chlorine was an effective terror weapon, and the sight of an oncoming cloud of the gas was a continual source of dread for the infantry. British retaliation. The British expressed outrage at Germany's use of poison gas at Ypres, but responded by developing their own gas warfare capability. The commander of British Chew Corps, Lieutenant General Ferguson, said of gas, "It is a cowardly form of warfare which does not commend itself to me or other English soldiers. We cannot win this war unless we kill or incapacitate more of our enemies than they do us, and if this can only be done by copying the enemy in his choice of weapons, we must not refuse to do so." In the end, the British Army embraced gas with enthusiasm and mounted more gas attacks than any other combatant. This was due partly to the British spending most of the latter years of the war on the offensive. Also, the prevailing wind on the Western Front was from the west, which meant the British more frequently had favorable conditions for a gas release than the Germans. The first use of gas by the British was at the Battle of Loos, 25th of September 1915, but the attempt was a disaster. Chlorine, codenamed Red Star, was the agent to be used, 150 tons arrayed in 5,500 cylinders, and the attack was dependent on favorable wind. However, on this occasion the wind proved fickle, and the gas either lingered in no man's land or, in places, blew back on the British trenches. 1915. More deadly gases. The deficiencies of chlorine were overcome with the introduction of phosgene, first used by France under the direction of French chemist Victor Grignard in 1915. Shortly afterwards, the Germans, under the direction of German chemist Fritz Haber, added small quantities of chlorine to increase the latter's toxicity. Phosgene was a potent killing agent, deadlier than chlorine. It had a potential drawback in that the symptoms of exposure took 24 hours or more to manifest, meaning that the victims were initially still capable of putting up a fight, although this could also mean that apparently fit troops would be incapacitated by the effects of the gas the following day. Phosgene was sometimes used on its own when it was difficult to detect, being colorless and having an odor likened to moldy hay. However, it is much denser than air, and so it was usually mixed with an equal volume of chlorine, the lighter chlorine helping to spread it. The Allies called this combination White Star after the marking painted on shells containing the mixture. In the first combined chlorine-phosgene attack by Germany against British troops at Niltia near Ypres, Belgium, on 19 December 1915, 88 tons of the gas were released from cylinders, causing 1,069 casualties and 69 deaths. The British added hexamethylnitramine to the chemicals in the filter of their gas masks as a counter to it in January 1916. 1917. Mustard gas. The most famous and effective gas of the First World War was mustard gas, a vesicant, which was introduced by Germany in July 1917, prior to the Third Battle of Ypres. Known to the British as HS, or Hun stuff, mustard gas was not intended as a killing agent, though in high enough doses it was fatal, but instead was used to harass and disable the enemy and pollute the battlefield. Delivered in artillery shells, mustard gas was heavier than air, settled to the ground as an oily, sherry-looking liquid, and evaporated slowly without sunlight. The polluting nature of mustard gas meant that it was not always suitable for supporting an attack, as the assaulting infantry would be exposed to the gas when they advanced. When Germany launched Operation Michael on 21st March 1918, they saturated the salient with mustard gas instead of attacking it directly, believing the harassing effect of the gas, coupled with threats to the salient's flanks, would make the British position untenable. Gas never reproduced the dramatic success of 22nd April 1915. However, it became a standard weapon which, combined with conventional artillery, was used to support most attacks in the later stages of the war. The Western Front was the main theater in which the gas was employed. The static, confined trench system was ideal for achieving an effective concentration. However, Germany made use of the gas against Russia on the Eastern Front, where the lack of effective countermeasures would result in deaths of thousands of Russian infantry, while Britain experimented with gas in Palestine during the Second Battle of Gaza. Post-war. By the end of the war, chemical weapons had lost much of their effectiveness against well-trained and equipped troops. At that time, one quarter of artillery shells fired contained chemical weapons, but these caused only 3% of the casualties. Nevertheless, in the following years, chemical weapons were used in several, mainly colonial, wars, where one side had an advantage in equipment over the other. The British used atom sight against Russian revolutionary troops in 1919 and mustered against Iraqi insurgents in the 1920s. Spain used chemical weapons in Morocco against Rif tribesmen throughout the 1920s, and Italy used mustard gas in Libya in 1930, and again during the invasion of Ethiopia in 1936. In 1925, a Chinese warlord, Zhang Zuolin, contracted a German company to build him a mustard plant in Shenyang, which was completed in 1927. Public opinion had by then turned against the use of such weapons, which led to the Geneva Protocol, a treaty banning the use, but not the stockpiling, of lethal gas and bacteriological weapons, which was signed by most First World War combatants in 1925. Most countries that signed ratified within around 5 years, although a few took much longer. Brazil, Japan, Uruguay, and the United States did not do so until the 1970s, and Nicaragua ratified it only in 1990. Although all major combatants stockpiled chemical weapons during the Second World War, the only reports of its use in the conflict were the Japanese use of relatively small amounts of mustard gas and lewisite in China, and very rare occurrences in Europe. For example, some sulfur mustard bombs were dropped on Warsaw on 3rd September 1939, which Germany acknowledged in 1942 but indicated that it had been accidental. Mustard gas was the first agent of choice, with the British stockpiling 40,719 tons, the Russians 77,400 tons, the Americans over 87,000 tons, and the Germans 27,597 tons. The mustard gas with which the British hoped to repel an invasion of the United Kingdom in 1940 was never needed, and a fear that the Allies also had nerve agents prevented the deployment in Germany. Nevertheless, poison gas technology played an important role in the Holocaust. Although chemical weapons have been used in at least a dozen wars since the end of the First World War, they have never been used again on such a large scale. Nevertheless, the use of mustard gas and more deadly nerve agents by Iraq during the 8-year Iran-Iraq War killed around 20,000 Iranian troops and injured another 80,000, around a quarter of the number of deaths caused by the chemical weapons during the First World War. Casualties. The contribution of gas weapons to the total casualty figures was relatively minor. British figures, which were accurately maintained from 1916 onward, reported that only 3% of gas casualties were fatal, 2% were permanently invalid, and 70% were fit for duty again within 6 weeks. All gas casualties were mentally scarred by exposure, and gas remained one of the greatest fears of a frontline soldier. Death by gas was particularly horrific. According to Dennis Winter, Death's Men, 1978, a fatal dose of oxygen eventually led to shallow breathing and retching, pulse up to 120, an ashen face, and the discharge of 4 pints, 2 liters, of yellow liquid from the lungs each hour for the 48 of the drowning spasm. A common fate of those exposed to gas was blindness, tear gas or mustard gas being the main causes. It became a frequent spectacle to see lines of blinded soldiers, hand on the shoulder of the man in front, being guided by a sighted man to a dressing station. One of the most famous First World War paintings, Gassed, by John Singer Sargent, captures such a scene of mustard gas casualties, which he witnessed at a dressing station at Le Bac du Sade near Arras in July 1918. Mustard gas caused the most gas casualties on the Western Front despite being produced in smaller quantities than irritant gases such as chlorine and phosgene. The proportion of mustard gas fatalities to total casualties was low. Only 2% of mustard gas casualties died, and many of these succumbed to secondary infections rather than the gas itself. Once introduced at Ypres, mustard gas produced 90% of all British gas casualties and 14% of battle casualties of any type. Mustard gas was a source of extreme dread. In The Anatomy of Courage, in 1945, Lord Moran, who had been a medical officer during the war, wrote, "After July 1917, gas partly usurped the role of high explosive in bringing to head a natural unfitness for war. The gassed men were an expression of trench fatigue, a menace when the manhood of the nation had been picked over." Mustard gas did not need to be inhaled to be effective. Any contact with the skin was sufficient. Exposure to 0.1 parts per million was enough to cause massive blisters. Higher concentrations could burn flesh to the bone. It was particularly effective against the soft skin of the face and genitals. Typical exposure would result in swelling of the conjunctiva and eyelids, forcing them closed and rendering the victim temporarily blind. Where it contacted the skin, moist red patches would immediately appear, which after 24 hours would have formed into blisters. Other symptoms included severe headache, alleviated pulse and temperature, and pneumonia. Death by mustard gas, when it came, was dreadful. A post-mortem account from the British Official Medical History records one of the first British casualties. Case 4, aged 39 years, gassed 29th July 1917, admitted to casualty clearing station the same day, died about 10 days later. Brownish pigmentation present over large surfaces of the body, a white ring of skin where the wristwatch was, marked superficial burning of the face and scrotum, the larynx much congested. The whole of the trachea was covered by a yellow membrane. The bronchi contained abundant gas, the lungs fairly voluminous, the right lung showing extensive collapse at the base, liver congested and fatty, stomach showed numerous submucous hemorrhages, the brain substance was unduly wet and very congested. A British nurse treating mustard gas cases recorded, "They cannot be bandaged or touched. We cover them with a tent of propped-up sheets. Gas burns must be agonizing because usually the other cases do not complain even with the worst wounds, but gas cases are invariably beyond endurance and they cannot help crying out." Many of those who survived a gas attack were scarred for life. Respiratory disease and failing eyesight were common post-war afflictions. Of the Canadians who, without any effective protection, had withstood the first chlorine attacks during Second Ypres, 60% of the casualties had to be repatriated, and half of these were still unfit by the end of the war, over 3 years later. In reading the statistics of the time, one should bear the longer term in mind. Many of those who were fairly soon recorded as fit for service were left with scar tissue in their lungs. This tissue was susceptible to tuberculosis attack. It was from this that many of the 1918 casualties died around the time of the Second World War, shortly before the sulfa drugs became widely available for its treatment. Countermeasures. None of the First World War combatants were prepared for the introduction of poison gas as a weapon. Once gas had appeared, development of gas protection began, and the process continued for much of the war, producing a series of increasingly effective gas masks. Even at second tier Brest, Germany, still unsure of the weapon's effectiveness, only issued breathing masks to the engineers handling the gas. At Ypres, a Canadian medical officer, who was also a chemist, quickly identified the gas as chlorine and recommended that the troops urinate on a cloth and hold it over the mouth and nose, the theory being that uric acid would crystallize the chlorine. The first official equipment issued was similarly crude, a pad of metal usually impregnated with a chemical tied over the lower face. To protect the eyes from tear gas, soldiers were issued gas goggles. The next advance was the introduction of the gas helmet, basically a bag placed over the head. The fabric of the bag was impregnated with a chemical to neutralize the gas. Whenever it rained, the chemical would wash out into the soldiers' eyes. Eyepieces, which were prone to fog up, were initially made from talc. When going into combat, gas helmets were typically worn rolled up on top of the head to be pulled down and secured about the neck when the gas alarm was given. The first British version was the hypo helmet, the fabric of which was soaked in calcium hypochlorite. The British P gas helmet, partially effective against phosgene and with which all infantry were equipped at Loos, was impregnated with phenate hexamine. A mouthpiece was later added through which the wearer would breathe out to prevent carbon dioxide buildup. The adjutant to the 123rd Battalion, the London Regiment, recalled his experience of the P helmet at Loos. The goggles rapidly dimmed over, and the air came through in such suffocatingly small quantities as to demand a continuous exercise of willpower on the part of the wearers. A modified version of the P helmet, called the PH helmet, was issued in January 1916 and was additionally impregnated with hexamethylenitramine to improve the protection against phosgene. Self-contained box respirators represented the culmination of gas mask development during the First World War. Box respirators used a two-piece design, a mouthpiece connected via a hose to a box filter. The box filter contained granules of chemicals that neutralized the gas, delivering clean air to the wearer. Separating the filter from the mask enabled a bulky but efficient filter to be supplied. Nevertheless, the first version, known as the Large Box Respirator, LBR, or Harrison's Tower, was deemed too bulky. The box canister needed to be carried on the back. The LBR had no mask, just a mouthpiece and nose clip. Separate gas goggles had to be worn. It continued to be issued to the artillery crews, but the infantry were supplied with the Small Box Respirator, or SBR. The Small Box Respirator featured a single-piece, close-fitting, rubberized mask with eyepieces. The box filter was compact and could be worn around the neck. The SBR could be readily upgraded as more effective filter technology was developed. The British-designed SBR was also adopted by the American Expeditionary Force. The SBR was the prized possession of the ordinary infantryman. When the British were forced to retreat during the German spring offensive of 1918, it was found that while some troops had discarded their rifles, hardly any had left behind their respirators. It was not only humans who needed to be protected from gas. Horses and mules, which were the main means of transport, were also vulnerable to gas and needed to be provided with protection. As animals were never used near the front line, protection from gas only became necessary when the practice of firing gas shells into rear areas was adopted. For mustard gas, which did not need to be inhaled in order to inflict casualties, no effective countermeasure was found during the war. The kilt-wearing Highland regiments of Scotland were especially vulnerable to mustard gas injuries due to their bare legs. At Nieuport, some Scots battalions took to wearing women's tights beneath their kilts as a form of protection. Gas alert procedure became a routine for the frontline soldier. To warn of a gas attack, a bell would be rung, often made from a spent artillery shell. At the noisy batteries of the siege guns, a compressed air strombus horn would be used, which could be heard 9 miles away. Notices would be posted on all approaches to an affected area, warning people to take precautions. Other British attempts at countermeasures were not so effective. An early plan was to use 100,000 fans to disperse the gas. Burning coal or carborundum gas was tried. A proposal was even made to equip frontline sentries with diving helmets, air being pumped to them through a 100-foot, 30-meter hose. However, the effectiveness of all countermeasures is apparent. In 1915, when poison gas was relatively new, less than 3% of British gas casualties died. In 1916, the proportion of fatalities jumped to 17%, but by 1918, the figure was back below 3%, though the total number of British gas casualties was 9 times the 1915 levels. Delivery systems. The first system employed for the mass delivery of gas involved releasing the gas from cylinders in a favorable wind, such that it was carried over the enemy's trenches. The main advantage of this method was that it was relatively simple and in suitable atmospheric conditions produced a concentrated cloud capable of overwhelming the gas mask defenses. The disadvantages of cylinder release were numerous. First and foremost, delivery was at the mercy of the wind. If the wind was fickle, as was the case at Luz, the gas could backfire, causing friendly casualties. Gas clouds gave plenty of warning, allowing the enemy time to protect themselves, though many soldiers found the sight of a creeping gas cloud unnerving. Also, gas clouds had limited penetration, only capable of affecting the front line trenches before dissipating. Finally, the cylinders had to be in place at the very front of the trench system so that the gas was released directly over no man's land. This meant that the cylinders had to be manhandled through communication trenches, often clogged and sodden, and stored at the front where there was always the risk that cylinders would be prematurely breached during a bombardment. A leaking cylinder could issue a telltale wisp of gas that, if spotted, would be sure to attract shell fire. A British chlorine cylinder, known as an Uja, weighed 190 pounds, 86 kilograms, of which only 60 pounds, 27 kilograms, was chlorine gas, and required two men to carry. Phosgene gas was introduced later in a cylinder known as a mouse that only weighed 50 pounds or 23 kilograms. Delivering gas via artillery shell overcame many of the risks of dealing with gas in cylinders. Gas shells were independent of the wind and increased the effective range of gas, making anywhere within reach of the guns vulnerable. Gas shells could be delivered without warning, especially the clear, nearly odorless phosgene. There are numerous accounts of gas shells landing with a plop rather than exploding, being initially dismissed as a dud, HE, or shrapnel shell, giving the gas time to work before the soldiers were alerted and took precautions. The main flaw associated with delivering gas via artillery was the difficulty of achieving a killing concentration. Each shell had a small gas payload, and an area would have to be subjected to a saturation bombardment to produce a cloud to match cylinder delivery. Mustard gas, however, did not need to form a concentrated cloud, and hence artillery was the ideal vehicle for the delivery of this battlefield pollutant. The solution to achieving a lethal concentration without releasing from cylinders was the gas projector, essentially a large bore mortar that fired the entire cylinder as a missile. The British Livens projector, invented by Captain W. H. Livens in 1917, was a simple device, an 8-inch diameter tube sunk into the ground at an angle. A propellant was ignited by an electrical signal firing the cylinder containing 30 or 40 pounds, 14 or 18 kilograms, of gas up to 1,900 meters. By arranging a battery of these projectors and firing them simultaneously, a dense concentration of gas could be achieved. The Livens was first used at Arras on 4th April 1917. On 31st March 1918, the British conducted their largest ever gas shoot, firing 3,728 cylinders at Lens. Unexploded weapons. Unexploded World War I ammunition, including chemical ammunition, was a major problem in former battle areas after the end of the war and has ever since been present. Shells may be, for instance, uncovered when farmers plow through their fields. More importantly, shells are regularly discovered when public works or construction work is done. While classical shells pose a risk of explosion, their disposal is relatively easy. It is not the case with chemical shells. An additional difficulty is the current stringency of environmental legislation. In the past, a common method of getting rid of unexploded chemical ammunition was to detonate or dump it at sea. This is nowadays prohibited in most countries. The problems are especially acute in some northern regions of France. The French government no longer disposes of chemical weapons at sea. For this reason, piles of untreated chemical weapons accumulated. In 2001, it became evident that the pile stored at a depot in Vimy was unsafe. The inhabitants of the neighboring town were evacuated, and the pile moved, using refrigerated trucks and under heavy guard, to a military camp in Sweets. The French government announced the construction of an automated plant for the dismantling of chemical munitions inherited from previous wars. This factory, codenamed Sequoia, is to be operational in 2007. The capacity of the plant is meant to be 25 tons per year, extensible to 80 tons at the beginning, for a lifetime of 30 years. In Belgium, a similar plant was planned in 1993 and brought into service in 1999, 2 years late, indicating the difficulties in disposal of such waste. Germany, too, has dealt with unexploded ammunition and polluted lands resulting from the explosion of an ammunition train in 1919. Effect on World War II. In the Geneva Gas Protocol of the Third Geneva Convention, signed in 1925, the signatory nations agreed not to use poison gas in the future, stating, "The use in war of asphyxiating, poisonous, or other gases, and of all analogous liquids, materials, or devices, has been justly condemned by the general opinion of the civilized world." Nevertheless, precautions were taken in World War II. In both Axis and Allied nations, children in schools were taught to wear gas masks in case of attack. Italy did use poison gas against Ethiopia in 1935 and 1936, and Japan used gas against China in 1941. Germany developed the poison gases Tabun, Sarin, and Soman during the war, and infamously used Zircon B in Nazi extermination camps. Germany did not use any of these gases in combat, possibly heeding Allied warnings of awful retaliation. This sound file and all the text in the article are licensed under the GNU Free Documentation License, available at www.gnu.org/copyleft/fdl.html. Have a nice day.